From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed so many things about American life. One of the most striking differences, for parents especially, is to have to oversee their children's education and the digital connection to schooling. For those parents and children who have felt a growing pressure to succeed, to obtain perfect grades, to maximize one's chances of entering exclusive colleges and universities, the pandemic may be even more difficult. But my guest points out in a new book that good schools, good grades, and good behavior are not enough, and that the intense world of high achievement education is not helpful. Pawan Dhingra is a professor of American Studies at Amherst College. He's the award-winning author of numerous books, including Life Behind the Lobby, Indian-American Motel Owners, and The American Dream. He joins me to discuss his new book, Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Welcome to the program, Pawan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the American education system is, of course, deeply unequal. We see in particular black and brown kids falling behind, just generally not getting the kind of support they need. But where Asians are concerned in particular, it's a different story. And we have this model minority stereotype. And you see Asian kids, South Asian, East Asian kids excelling in schools in the way that white kids tend to excel at school, sometimes even more so. Is it a myth, this idea that the Asian kids are, you know, just better at math and science or much more successful, much more driven, their parents, you know, the tiger mom sort of stereotype? Is that a real stereotype?
You do find that, you know, there are tiger parents, and you do find that in some school districts, Asian Americans overachieve above whites and other groups. But you also find school districts where Asian Americans are struggling, aren't getting the resources or attention they need, in part because of that exact stereotype that you mentioned, the assumption that Asian Americans must be doing well, their parents are on top of things and are very driven, and so they kind of fall through the cracks, even though they may need more attention than other students. And the idea about their parents being tiger parents, you know, it, again, is a, you will find tiger parents, but you also find parents who are too extreme across all kinds of families, Asian, non-Asian, about academics, about sports, about anything. And so the myth, right, what the problem with the myth is that even if you can find support for it, it overlooks so many differences that we need to pay attention to, and it kind of essentializes a culture when in fact there's a lot of variety across different groups.
Now, the obsession, American obsession with measuring the outcomes of schooling seems to have fed into this desire for good grades. We have high-stakes testing. Schools and teachers are measured by the results of standardized testing. If you want to get into a good college, you know, for decades, you've had to take the SAT. And that seems to have really contributed to the pressure that parents place on their children and that children even place on themselves, right? Because they see the entirety of their education measured by letter grades or by a portfolio that they effectively have to submit to college applications that demands that they be these well-rounded, perfect students. How serious is that pressure?
The pressure is, I'm glad you brought this up, the pressure is extreme, and it's coming from so many different parts, right? So on the one hand, right, the students themselves feel it, and we're not talking just about high school juniors or seniors or even freshmen. We're talking about third graders. I talked with a health expert at an elementary school who said she sees third graders who are so stressed they become nonverbal. She asked them, what do you worry about? And these third graders will say the SAT, getting into college. I've had a kindergarten teacher tell me that she sees the children so tired, so overworked and worried. Right. So this is a real issue at our younger grades, and that's something I really was surprised by but wanted to draw attention to. Because when we think about parents wanting more education for their kids, we can say, well, yeah, at a certain age, you might think that makes sense, even if we can find, you know, reasons that we don't like it. But what I'm talking about here are middle school students, elementary students, even pre-elementary. And I'm not referring to extreme families like the, you know, the Upper East Side of Manhattan who are just, you know, driven to this one idea. We're talking about everyday families, middle class families oftentimes, who are seeing not just school get more competitive and therefore wanting their kids to have an advantage, but to your other point, there's so much assessment going on in our schools and so much concern and critique about our teachers. So, for instance, the Gates Foundation has done a lot of work, mostly to the detriment of schools, by criticizing teachers, trying to assess them more. And what that impact that has on parents is to say, well, maybe my teachers aren't that good. Maybe I should be worried about the quality of my kids' schools, even though the schools could be doing just fine. So parents feel worried, not just about getting into school, higher ed, but about the quality of their kids' education at a young age. And so it makes sense to them to start seeking extra opportunities outside of school. And that's how this whole domino effect starts.
And there's a whole industry that you write about outside of the education system for kids to get extra tutoring. You know, these companies like Kumon, how do you pronounce it actually?
Kumon, right.
Kumon, all right. Mathlete and so many of these many of them actually now corporate chains around the country, where outside of schools, parents worry that their kids' math grades or science grades or history grades might not be up to par, are taking them, paying through the nose to subject them to even more hours of education. How lucrative is this industry? And how much does it impact the mental health in particular of young people?
Yeah, I'm glad you focused on mental health, but just in terms of the growth of the industry, right? These are some of the fastest growing companies in the country, and even before COVID. And I think that with remote learning and the turn to remote learning and the concerns parents now have about their kids' education from schools, I think this is just going to make this even more of a growth industry. And it's not just because parents are worried. These companies got funding from No Child Left Behind. They got these tutoring in general got billions of dollars from No Child Left Behind. The relief packages that the Betsy DeVos administration is putting forward has money for tutoring as well. And so these companies are prone to grow even more at a moment when other industries are shrinking, partly because parents see them as an additive or a corrective even to their school system. So this is going to become even more of a new normal, and the consequences are many. One is the growing educational gap between those who can afford these places and those who can't. And then, as you already alluded to, right, the mental health concerns, and not just the mental health of those who are in these industries, but even those who aren't. So just a quick example, I talked with a lot of teachers and educators, and they said they see stress not just among those who are kind of overscheduled in this way, but among students who aren't doing this extra academics, because those students who are doing just fine in school, they're at grade level, no longer see themselves as being adequate in a subject because their peers are doing more than them. They're more advanced. And so you see a lot of concern and anxiety among students who are in a peripheral sense, right? Because they're not taking part in this. And I'm not trying to demonize these companies. I'm just trying to convey that because this is a growth industry, and in part because of actions by the Gates Foundation, actions by the federal government, the gap in education is just going to grow more and more.
And we've seen in recent, in the past year, the college scam, as it's been called, where Hollywood celebrities using their money and clout have, you know, been so desperate to get their kids into top colleges that they've essentially, you know, falsified data or paid to have it falsified and paid to cheat, which may be sort of that extreme end of that spectrum. I want to focus on the spelling bee, because you go into that in your book. There's, of course, there's no doubt about the fact that Indian American kids in particular dominate spelling bee winners. And I'm wondering if you can take a side trip down that path in this conversation to why that is the case.
Right. So the reason why I focused on spelling bees as an example is that parents, this is how I kind of got into the book. I was talking with parents who were doing spelling bees, and I was kind of fascinated by this trend a little bit. And then they said, we don't really care about spelling. Like, I was really, that seems to be odd because you're spending a lot of time on spelling bees. And they said, what we care about is that our kids get more education outside of school. And that was what got me down this road of thinking about, well, if that's really the concern, then where is this kind of growth in education outside of school? And that's what led me to these after-school learning companies. But in terms of the spelling bee itself, Indians have been dominating it for 20 years. And partly it's because as they started kind of performing and getting a bit of a name in it, even without necessarily winning it, other Indians took notice and said, oh, here's a sphere in which people like us are doing quite well, or at least can perform. We should do more of this. And so what then grew were spelling bees just for other Indians. So spelling bees put on by and serving just other Indians or South Asians started to take place, which means then South Asians have more access to these bees. They can get more training in them. And it becomes like not just an individual pursuit or even a family pursuit. It becomes a community pursuit. And so you kind of measure yourself against other kids. Parents are seeing what other kids are doing that they know. And you know, like a lot of parents, you see someone else doing something, you think, oh, maybe I should, my kids should do that. So that became a trend. And I remember talking with one mother at a spelling bee, and I said, well, why spelling? Why not chess? Like, you know, some other kind of activity that's you could see as maybe, you know, that could be a space, a venue for Indians. And she said, wait until you see the first Indian champion in chess. Then everyone's going to gravitate towards it. So it is a sense of where, as immigrants, this is not unique to Indians. When you're trying to get a foothold in this country, where can our kids fit in? If you see some people in your community doing well in a certain sector, that becomes a space where you want to do more in. And the other corollary to this is that sports, traditional sports, is the most common activity families do after school. But it's not a space where many Asian Americans feel that they can really excel, especially in team sports that are most coveted and popular. So the parents say, if our kids aren't going to excel there, we have to find some venue for them to achieve. And education in general and competitive academics in particular becomes that venue. And one last thing I'll just quickly say is, like, why are parents so invested in education? Why this? And they say, listen, we're immigrants here. We don't know that many people. And so for our kids to get ahead, they really have to know more than most kids do because we don't have the connections to get them ahead. Right? In the typical, you know, adage is that it's not what you know, it's who you know. But if you don't know that many people, then it really is what you know that kind of shapes your
right.
mobility.
And people of color know that they generally have to compete twice as hard. Women know they have to compete twice as hard, maybe four times as hard, in order to achieve the same success as their white peers or their male peers. So the question then is, if the enormous pressure to succeed in school, that is to get good grades, to behave well, to get into good colleges, if that pressure is so huge and it results in this tremendous high stakes, high achievement culture, it, does it actually work? Do parents find that their children have amazing lives after all of this investment? And it becomes a family investment, an emotional and a financial, and even a health investment in their children's success, quote unquote. Does
yeah,
it work?
I talked with some college admissions officers as part of this, and I asked them, you know, so what do you think about this plan, this trajectory? And they were all very skeptical of it. They said, listen, you're not going to be able to program kids to excel in kind of predetermined ways as a means to help them kind of stand out in a college application process. That does not work. And they were very adamant about this is not a healthy application process. They see a lot of kids who seem to fit that profile, and the kids themselves don't come across as compelling because you can sometimes tell, at least the admissions officers believe they could tell, when it was being – something that was done to the children versus something the children wanted to do. So there's no clear, like, you know, this never works or it always works. The net result of what I want to convey is that we really have to listen to the kids more. That is, if your child is someone who finds, you know, academics as a venue for them to, you know, perform, to enjoy, then giving them more opportunities for that through homemade versions or something else can be a great idea. But it has to come from the kids. And the kids who do, for instance, the spelling bees, they go on to, you know, years later, I talked to many past champions and finalists, and they actually are very well-rounded. They're, you know, very well-grounded. They've done quite well for themselves later on in life. But those people, really wanted to do what they were doing at a young age. And so the parents are oftentimes along for the ride, not driving the kids in a particular direction.
So you also point out that in some ways this drive to push kids to succeed also becomes about their morality, about the morality of children. Well, if they're busy going to these extracurricular, you know, private tutoring sessions, they're less likely to get in trouble. Can you explore that a little bit and what that says about our society today?
I'm glad you brought that up. So a lot of parents put their kids in activities in order to keep them busy, right? And then if my kids are doing something, you know, like spelling or math or, you know, even baseball, softball, they won't be watching a TV. And so that there's somehow like that's just good. But what I'm talking about is what you're alluding to is actually much deeper than that. I talked with one mother, you know, U.S. born white mother, and I asked her what, not why she did the after-school math class once a week, but what she worried would happen if she didn't do it. And she said, my grandmother survived the Holocaust. My parents put me through college through hard work. I want to instill those same values into my kids, which is why I have them in this after-school math class. In other words, she drew a line between surviving the Holocaust and a once-a-week math class. And she wasn't alone or even extreme. A lot of parents kind of imbued a deep moral kind of grounding and values to what they were doing. And so they weren't just raising smarter kids or more prepared kids or more competitive kids. They're raising better kids, like good people, moral people.
Are they, and though?
Well, that's a good thing. And so even the parents I spoke to, and I kind of pushed them on this. Well, you know, why do you think that's actually the case? Isn't this creating more competition? And I think in our current COVID moment, right, what we're learning more than any other time is the importance of compassion, right, of caring for others. You're not getting that by being in a competitive academic process. And parents would realize this. We're doing this because we want to create certain kinds of kids. But you're right. Are we losing creativity? Are we losing compassion? So parents struggled with this. And so they really don't come out as saying, no, it's always for the best. They're very aware of the cost benefits. But yet they still felt compelled to do this out of a sense of fear that if we don't do this, our kids could fall behind. And that's kind of the tension that parents feel themselves in.
Well, finally, what advice would you give parents? Having studied this and written this book, I have two kids. They go to a Montessori school. There's no grades. And I've sort of avidly avoided that, although I was a hyper overachieving child without pressure from my parents. They didn't really particularly care if I worked terribly hard and pushed myself to get good grades, but I pushed myself and now I don't feel like I want to push my children. But at the same time, of course, every parent wants their kid at least to be happy, if not to be the most successful in the world. What advice would you give parents?
So I have two kids and they both did Montessori also, so I can relate much to what you're saying. And my advice, and I kind of end the book with, is we need to be parenting less out of a place of fear and competition. Because when we do that, which may seem obvious, but that really is the dominant motivation a lot of times. Other kids are doing something. If I don't do it for my kids, they'll be behind. That's a place of fear. That's a place of competition. And it's very normal. And it's very natural. But if that's the mindset, then there's no end. You never stop because you're always trying to outcompete. Instead, we have to be parenting from a sense of opportunity. I'm not saying never enroll your kids in something, never consider something academic outside of school. That's absurd to say that kind of blanket statement. Instead, what opportunities do you see your kids most excited about, most enthused for? What do your kids talk about at the dinner table? What do your kids talk about when they're tying their shoes? Use that as opportunities to further their interest in a more organic way. Trust in that, right? And if we do that, we're able to create both opportunities for the kids and hopefully keep them from feeling burned out and feeling resentful, right? And that's oftentimes what we worry about. And a lot of educators worried about too. And so that's part of what I'm trying to convey to parents through this book.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Pavan, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Pavan Dhingra, professor of American Studies at Amherst College. He's an award-winning author of numerous books, including Life Behind the Lobby, Indian American Motel Owners and the American Dream. We've been talking about his latest book, Hyper-Education, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.